This is the 911 Calls Podcast with the operator and his exact twin, minus being born and raised in Kentucky and his heroic military service and being born to a completely other mother, Kent Chungus.
Yes, please, this is an emergency. Please send a squadron. Just on the road.
Welcome to the 911 Calls Podcast with Kent Chungus and his slightly trusted but constantly side-eyed co-host, the operator. I am your host, Kent Chungus, and joining me today is a man that needs more than an introduction, but we just don't have time, the operator. Hello, op.
What's happening?
It's opposite day.
It's weird.
Are you nervous right now?
Well, here's the weird feeling that I've got is
I feel like you're nervous right now.
I'm nervous.
The fuck is your problem?
I'm nervous because I know the caliber of research you do at TCK, and so I'm kind of like, you know what? Actually, ever since I found out you're going to do the show today, I was like, you know what? I kind of felt that, you know, like when you see retirement coming.
Yeah.
I was like, this might be
passing of the torch, maybe.
This might be my way out.
Yeah.
We'll see.
So obviously I can't do the level of research with this that I do at TCK. TCK episodes are sometimes three episodes long, and if it's a single episode, they're sometimes 3 hours long. We don't have that kind of time here. But I was wondering if this feels weird to you because, like,
right,
you've been driving this 911 vehicle for well over 3 years now. The first 911 episode dropped February 20th, 2020. I don't know if you knew that.
That's a long time. I didn't know that. That's wow.
But I think this is the first time that somebody else has taken the wheel, huh? Or maybe even had the wheel at all.
I think, yes. What used to be, well, the second recording that Jack and I ever did, he was like, how about I do the happy ending? I was like, okay. And then he played a call of an old lady.
Some people call that the glory days of 911 calls.
And some people aren't even listening to us say this because they left when Jack left.
Yes.
So, but he played a call of an old lady being murdered on the 911 call during a home invasion as the happy ending.
Oh.
So I was like, it's probably the last time I'll.
I would never do that.
Yeah. I know you wouldn't, buddy. That's why I was like, this is a great, let's do this. Can I be really honest? The real reason that I was like really actually super excited for you to do this is because I am always frustrated. I'm frustrated twice. I'm frustrated when I hear that people are like, no, I've never listened to True Crime Kent. Because to me, if you like this show, you will meet my other frustration, which is listen to True Crime Kent, and then I will be as equally frustrated as I always am, because when I ask people what their favorite show is of 1159, they always say True Crime Kent. So that...
that wasn't the case for like 3 years, though.
Well...
it's been a long, slow...
burn.
Build.
Yeah.
Well, if everybody is panicking, don't. There are no worrisome changes going on here at 1159 Media. Op is just going to be quitting this podcast. And now I would like to introduce my new co-host, Aaron Mankey of Lore. Aaron, how are you doing? And directly behind him, if this doesn't work out, Aaron, you fucking fucker, we have a pigeon riding a little unicycle. So that's going to be fun. Now what you need to do, impersonate Aaron Mankey of Lore, what you need to do is speak in 7 to 8 word sentences, okay, like this. And then when you respond, just talk like this. Just imagine you're a GPS.
Before I leave this show, I really should check to see how much my 401k has vested. Oh, wait, that's right. I'm a podcaster. I don't have a 401k.
Now, all jokes aside, this is a one-off episode where I'm taking the wheel here. If you hate it, no worries. It's probably going to be the last time. If you love it, no worries. It'll probably eventually happen again.
Oh,
You got any riffraff or bullshit you want to go into before we get into this call? You want to talk about the fucking Silver War or the Rings of Jupiter?
No.
Meteorites, something directly related to these calls, this call that we're going to be listening to today. Or calls, we have several.
I believe you're going to be happy with this. I have some fun facts to know and share. And I think you're both going to be, your mind will be boggled. And you'll also be impressed with how I've dialed it in with the accuracy and relevance of what you said the calls were going to be about and my fun facts to know and share.
We'll see.
Okay. Well, so without further abuse.
Yeah, we'll see. Here we go on a 10-minute tirade about the dwindling population of cheetahs in the tundra.
No, I would never do that. Here's what I would do, though. Fact number one, though a classic cereal bowl favorite, Smacks consistently rank first on the list of bad-for-you cereals. Honey Smacks.
Also the worst cereal.
Used to be called Sugar Smacks, but then they were like, oh, no. So they changed the name to Honey Smacks like we're idiots and we don't know.
I think the original title was Bowl O' Shit.
I still don't know what they are.
And why is the mascot a frog? One thing I love thinking about when I'm eating cereal is a slimy, pond scum-covered frog.
Also, I don't want to remind you of the shape of Sugar Smacks, but, you know, that's also a thing.
I don't remember. Sugar Smacks.
Just look it up. Also,
oh, you're talking about Honey Smacks?
Well, yeah, it used to be called Sugar Smacks. And then they changed the name to Honey Smacks because they thought that we would buy more of it if it didn't say sugar on it anymore.
They just look like little butt pussies.
There's like three or four things it could be.
No, there's not.
Hot dog bun was the top of my list, but, you know.
Okay, hot dog bun pussies. Okay.
More than one cup of coated puffs contains more sugar than an entire Twinkie.
And it's still terrible.
Bowl of Honey Smacks contains as much sugar as a Dunkin' Donut.
Ugh.
Revving up your kids, sending them to school. How about this? The creepy stare that you get from the mascot on your box of cereal is actually no accident. You ever notice how the characters on really sugary cereal boxes always seem to be like looking down at something?
Yeah.
Rather than staring you in the eyes?
It's because of on the shelf, their location on the shelf in the grocery store?
Well, it's because the advertisers use this technique to put the box's mascot at eye level with the kids roaming the aisles in the supermarkets. So what you're saying. So the kids are small. So the bunny staring at what we think is the Trix bowl is actually staring at our child. Boy.
I'm a Fruity Pebbles guy.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing like Fruity Pebbles. Fruity Pebbles in the first 2.5 minutes of eating it. Anything after that is fruity concrete mix.
I love it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll pour a bowl and then go, I was going to say exercise, but
yeah.
Let's keep it real. Watch Netflix. I'll go eat another cereal. I'll go pour a bowl of Fruit Loops while the Fruity Pebbles turns into that cement, turns into oatmeal.
Yeah.
And then I'll eat my fruity oatmeal.
Rainbow oatmeal. Oh.
And the Fruity Pebble milk is the best.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty darn good. Oh, I just had a bowl of something magical last night. I had a bowl of mini Reese's Puffs. There are a handful of cereals right now that you can go in the grocery store and find mini, mini versions of.
Yeah, those are delicious.
So they also have, I think they have mini honeycomb, so they don't tear your mouth up like honeycomb do, because eating honeycomb is like eating
razor blades,
Tinker toy pieces. They're just gigantic.
Yeah. It's like somebody threw a roll of barbed wire in one of those shredders that you see them throwing car parts and stuff in.
Yeah.
And then they put a bowl underneath it. With milk.
Yeah.
I feel like that fucking rock giant from The Neverending Story when I'm eating that shit.
This mouth, it used to be a good mouth.
Anyway, so here's another one. Tony the Tiger from Frosted Flakes fame.
Yeah.
He got the job as Tony the Tiger in 1952, but he was beat out and beat off the box by Katie the Kangaroo in 1953.
Mm.
But he beat his way right back onto the box the next year, and he's promoted the Flakes with great enthusiasm ever since.
Looking at Katie the Kangaroo here, she looks like a real bitch.
Apparently she was really hard to work with.
The Katie the Kangaroo has very slave owner vibes.
Yeah.
You look at her, I'm not kidding, look it up. You look at that. If there's ever been a kangaroo that owns slaves, it's Katie the Kangaroo. Look it up. She's wearing a straw hat with flowers on it, a blue bandana around her neck. Well, not like in a cool way, like a, woo, must be hot out here in the cotton kind of way. That kangaroo has owned slaves, I swear on it.
How about this one? Did you know that Snap, Crackle, and Pop actually killed their fourth brother off early on in the 50s?
No.
Yeah. So it used to be Snap, Crackle, Pop, and Pow. And it was like more space-oriented branding. But then I don't know if it was just box, you know, box real estate. There wasn't enough for four. But Pow got offed. And he's no longer, you know, no, I don't even know what he went on to do after that.
Nothing. What if they made a backstory where he fucking died? Like gun safety accident?
Pow.
Snap, Crackle, and Pop!
Snap, Crackle, whoop. Okay.
Snap, Crackle, and whatever that line is for flatlining, whatever noise that makes.
All right, you're qualified to give me one word answer for this next one.
Okay.
What do you think cornflakes were invented to diminish?
This isn't a fair question because I know the answer.
Ah, okay, fine. Go ahead.
Constipation.
Actually, you got the last part of the word right. Cornflakes were invented to squash masturbation.
I thought they were invented to because it was to make shitting easier.
Cornflakes were originally intended to kill your sex drive during the pious 1800s when everyone in the
same reason Rosie O'Donnell was invented.
When everybody was discouraging anything sexual or remotely pleasurable in the 1800s, a physician named John Harvey Kellogg thought that a bland food could actually curb sexual appetite. Thinking of that sexual activity was unhealthy and the root of all physical and mental ailments, he created a health treat of flavorless ground up bits of oatmeal and cornmeal to serve to his sanitarium patients. He called it granola. Today we call it cornflakes.
I love cornflakes.
Me too. I also don't have a sex drive, so...
I'm trying to do the math here. I haven't masturbated since 98. I need to lay off the cornflakes and slamming my dick in the door.
God. So here's a mystery. What is one ingredient that you can find in a whole bunch of other cereals that is almost absent completely in Cocoa Krispies?
Cocoa Krispies?
Yeah.
I would say this is a trick question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say sugar.
Chocolate. There is, contains almost no chocolate. That flavor that you're picking up when you're eating Cocoa Krispies is mostly sugar, vanilla, and malt flavoring.
Ah.
But the brown color tricks our brains into thinking it's crap. I mean, chocolate.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Cocoa Krispies.
I'm not really. I got a bunch of these, but I'm going to peel off because I want to get back to your episode. I just want to know, are you proud of me for bringing features and information, fun facts ahead of your call that line up with the call this time?
I have a fun cereal fact.
Okay.
About Cocoa Krispies.
All right.
That is what EMS and first responders refer to as an African American that has died in a house fire.
Stop it. You know what? I'm going to go one step further. I'll challenge you. I'll bet you they call everyone that dies in a house fire that, because they're just all
us.
Jess had huge eyes just now, and then she covered them. That is the equivalent. Oh, wow. Wow.
Maybe we should start the episode.
Yeah, let's start it.
Oh, this is, and if 911 burns down, I'd be proud to make it the one episode that I hosted. That's a good feeling. That's a good feeling. Because this show has been the workhorse of 1159 Media, and
yeah,
just one ride behind the wheel, and call me Paul.
That's kind of the hard part is that somehow this show keeps our whole thing alive. But it's not the most popular? I don't even understand. I don't get it. I don't care. I'm crying inside. It's fine.
Today, we're going to St. Paul, Minnesota. That's where we're going. And our story starts late at night on December 31st. I think this might be, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think I may have the honor, because this is something I've always wanted to cover on 911 calls. I always like, what about older 911 calls? I think these are the oldest 911 calls that have ever been covered on 911.
I would say so. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Jack came close with that murdered old lady in the happy ending on that episode early on, but no, this one beats that even as far as dates.
So we're going to St. Paul, Minnesota, and our story here starts late in the night of December 31st. 1980.
Oof.
1980. This is a 43-year-old story. And the calls, 43 years old. And on this night, 20-year-old college student by the name of Karen Potak was walking home from a New Year's Eve party, just being a young whippersnapper, when she is suddenly hit over the head from behind with a tire iron. The assault there happened behind the Malberg Manufacturing Machine Shop. And it was beside some train tracks at 886 North Syndicate Street. At least that's where she was found.
Oh.
So behind the Malberg Manufacturing Machine Shop and beside some train tracks at 886 North Syndicate Street. Now, she was left laying there after being hit over the head, unconscious and badly bleeding. A few hours, so she's laying there beside the train tracks behind this machine shop. She lays there for a few hours, and in the early morning hours of January 1st, the next day, 1981, the first of many calls over the next few months is placed to the Minneapolis 911 dispatch. Get used to the voice of this man. This is the first call.
Yes, please. This is an emergency. Please send a squadron. Just on the road. Malmberg Manufacturing Company Machine Shop. Please, there's an ambulance too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
She's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the air train.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you?
Yes, please.
Whoa. I know that sounds like a prank call. It is not. This guy's being 100% serious. Police, after getting this call, found Karen back there beside the train tracks, and she fortunately survived, but she didn't remember the attack, and she didn't have a description of the perpetrator because she suffered minor brain damage in the incident. She didn't remember any of it. 6 months later, 7:15 p.m. on Wednesday evening, June 3rd, 1981, that's when the body of an 18-year-old girl who was named Kimberly Compton is found by three young boys who were out running around playing cowboys and Indians and probably exploring each other's bodies and are, I don't know, three young boys. I remember being curious about all sorts of bodies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably out poking dead raccoons with a stick and then Kimberly Compton, but it's,
jeez.
Look, I don't know. I'm just trying to put my mind and I'm just trying to think like a young boy. It's like Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
three young boys. They find this body of this 18-year-old girl there 6 months after this first call is made. It's Kimberly Compton by young boys out playing. They probably found a Hustler magazine in the woods. You know the story. It's the story as old as time. You found a Hustler, you take turns hunching behind a log in the woods. You all blow it on a leaf. It's like a agreed upon leaf. Because you think the police are going to investigate if they find out you're masturbating in the woods. So you're like, we all got to blow it on this leaf and then bury it deep so that there's no evidence. And then one friend would be designated to keep the Hustler magazine. You'd be like, you keep it Tuesday, and I'll keep it Wednesday. And then we'll meet up on Thursday in the cave. We'll blow it on a rock. Then we'll bury the rock. You felt like you were committing a crime. But that wasn't the crime here. Back to the story. Okay. 18-year-old Kimberly Compton is found dead by these three young boys that are out playing. They discovered her on the west end of St. Paul in a grassy plot of land near Interstate 35E. Now, Kimberly was new in town. She had grown up in a foster home, didn't have a great upbringing. It was a very sad backstory. She was known in school as a quiet, shy girl. She tried to make friends, but according to one of the teachers, wasn't very good at it. She didn't do drugs. She didn't drink alcohol. She was just kind of the girl that you would see in school that would be holding her books tight with her chin down.
Yeah.
Right. Like you always see that girl in movies from the 80s.
Yeah, that's how I did it.
Like, no, I don't want to go behind the bleachers, Billy.
Yeah.
That girl.
Yep. Yep. That was me.
But she's new in town here. She had graduated from high school in Wisconsin just 2 weeks prior and was in Minnesota here in St. Paul looking for a job. So she's fresh out of school, 2 weeks out of high school. She's here in Minnesota. She's looking for a job. She's trying to grow up. She's shy. She's new in town. And when these boys find her corpse, she has 61 stab wounds, most of which were in her chest. Now, police believed upon autopsy that the murder weapon was a screwdriver. That's what they thought at first. She also had marks around her neck that looked like she'd been strangled with a thin rope. Something like maybe a shoelace or tobacco string. I don't know if you're kind of a city kid, so I don't know if you know what tobacco string is, but it's like not ideal for murders.
Is it what you would use to hang tobacco?
No. You hang tobacco from tobacco sticks. Oh. You bell tobacco with tobacco string.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's like made out of like the same thing that they make burlap sacks out of.
Oh.
It's woven into a little thin rope.
Very uncomfortable on the hand.
Very uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, beside her body, Kimberly's body, they only found two things that were pretty much useless to the investigation because both of them belonged to Kimberly. Her coin purse was there, and inside it was the money from her welfare benefits, a total of $18, and a book that she was reading at the time called The Last Battle by C.S. Lewis. They determined she'd been dead for about 3 hours when the body was finally found, and that meant that she had been murdered around 4:15 p.m. that day. So in the middle of the afternoon, getting up on the evening, 4:15 that day. She had last been seen getting off a bus there in St. Paul at around 3 p.m. that day. And since she was from Wisconsin, that means that she was murdered literally within an hour and 15 minutes of arriving to St. Paul, Minnesota, which isn't good for tourism.
Wow, that's very quick.
An hour and 15 minutes in a new city. Look at that. And you shouldn't laugh at that.
Yeah, Jess.
You shouldn't. That was...
Stop laughing.
Basically, what happened? Imagine you get off the ferry right at New York City. Oh, look, it's the statue. That's essentially what happened here. But June 6, 1981, so they found this body, you know. June 6, 1981, 3 days later, a call is placed to the Minneapolis 911 dispatch, and they determined that call had been placed from the payphone across the street from the very bus stop station that Kimberly had been last seen at 9th and St. Peter Streets. So that bus stop station, that Greyhound station, was at 9th and St. Peter Streets. Here's that call. Are you ready for you to hit play up?
Yeah. Here we go.
Now say, oh, daddy, put that big cock in. Say it all.
Can't do it.
Say, slide that big, juicy cock in my armpit.
Here's the call.
Just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I hadn't ever been so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every day. I can't believe it. It's like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'll kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else.
So that's reassuring.
Here's something about that. When I was young, I would get calls from my grandpa, my dad's dad, and he would call me and ask me to come over and like trim the hedges or mow the lawn. This voice sounds just like my grandpa, which is really hard to listen to because he would call and he'd be like, "How's
your grandpa? How old were you?"
Oh, I was probably, I could drive most of the time, I think. So I was probably between 14 and 18 when, you know.
Your grandpa's calling you at 14 and going, I'll try not to kill anybody else.
No, but he would call and be like, ha.
That's a lot to weigh on a 14-year-old.
He would say, hi, Sam. Could you come by and mow the lawn?
It does sound like somebody doing a voice for a Muppet.
Yeah.
From Sesame Street.
Or like, commercial needs Halloween voice guy.
Oh, hey, kids.
Halloween voice guy that leaves nightmares for all eternity. It's supposed to sound like you feel bad for him, but for some reason you just feel dirty.
I'll try not to kill anybody else.
That's not reassuring at all.
Not at all. No.
I mean, if somebody says to me, if somebody, like, they throw their grass clippings in the road, right? And they're like, I'll try not to get my grass clippings back in the road. I'd be like, oh, he might do that. He might keep an eye on it the next time. But if somebody's having trouble not killing somebody, I don't think they're going to win that battle.
I don't either.
100% of the time, they're going to kill somebody again.
Yeah, especially if they're calling. Like, if they're calling to let you know that they did it again.
What if he was just really clumsy?
Oh, that would be... Oh, here's a story. So I have a niece, and we have her babysit all the time. And without fail, you know that she babysat for us, because when you come home, there are like fingerprints that were dipped in something on everything. The refrigerator handle has like fingerprint swipe smudge of chocolate. The house might smell of burning something. Like, she's so absent-mindedly messy. Get this. We saw her at the local town little fair this last weekend. My wife had just gotten some new cool Sorels. They're like these low cut. They're really cute. And they say Sorel on the bottom. And they're, yeah, they're really.
I don't know what a Sorella is.
Sorel. S-O-R-E-L. Sorel.
Does the laces wrap around the bottom or?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Anyway, they're new shoes and they're really cute.
Oh.
They're like Keds on steroids.
Oh.
But she's got several pairs of different, I don't want to brag about my wife's shoes, but she will. But anyway, so I'm standing there with her. We see my niece and she gives her a big hug. She's like, oh my gosh. And she's 14. She's like, oh my gosh. And she's with her friends. So, you know, it's overly drama. And she's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm seeing you. I feel like I belong. And we walk away. We get like a scone and we go over and we sit down on this table. And she looks down at her shoes. And her shoes have, it looks like somebody poured juice all over one. And she's like, how did that happen? Where did I get?
Why would somebody pour juice all over them?
I don't know either. But we're sitting there like, when would that have happened? She goes, I know these were clean when I got in the car. And then she was like, oh my gosh, I gave Olivia a hug and she had a Slurpee in her hand.
Ah, there it is.
So not only can she get herself and your house messy, she can come within orbit of your own body and get you messy as well.
Wasn't she supposed to be at the house preventing the messes?
Well, not that time.
That's like half the job of the babysitter.
Yeah.
Like making sure you as the child don't die and making sure that people don't draw dicks on the wall and crayon.
Part of the problem is she paired up with Mona, who is our high maintenance. Hey, Dad, do you have any spare plutonium for a project I'm working on? Like those two together, it's Danger City. Something's going to melt. Something's going to burn. Something's going to blow.
Right.
Anyway, I feel like I took us off track, but that was because that was an important story tying in.
I actually left a, if you're looking at the outline, I left the spot. Op takes us off track.
Yeah, right there. So,
so everything's going.
Yeah.
You still got another 2 minutes if you want to talk about cereal.
No, I'm good.
Okay. Add the 2 minutes to the end. So this guy so far has knocked one young lady unconscious. He's called and said, oh, I hope I don't kill again. And now he's killed Kimberly Compton. He's called. So we've got one serious injury and one murder. And we don't hear anything else again from him until 2 months later. And that happens at 6:30 a.m. Actually, this isn't when we hear from him. This is when he strikes again. At 6:30 a.m. on Friday, August the 21st of 1981. This is 2 months after the first murder. That's when the body of a 40-year-old nurse named Barbara Virginia Simons is found by a little newspaper boy near the Mississippi River on a wooded embankment near West River Road with around 40 stab wounds. Now, depending on what old newspaper you read, some will say 40 stab wounds, some will say upwards of 100. So I'm guessing at a certain point, it starts getting hard counting stab wounds, or we only had so many fingers in the 80s.
Also this, it's curious that they would talk about Barbara Virginia Simons when... What? How many stab wounds did the newspaper boy have?
He didn't have any stab wounds. He was delivering the news.
Oh, because you
and
said
he found
that she was found by a newspaper boy near the Mississippi River. Like I was picturing in my head that they were laying next to each other dead.
No.
Okay. This is the first time in this episode where I've been a little bit remiss about the quality of the research, because I think I could have clarified that better on my own show.
Go ahead and throw it up in the AI and see what it comes up with. The newspaper boy was also an ulcer survivor. His name was Henry, and he died in 1873. That's odd, because this is 1981. If you like this, look into Jimi Hendrix. What? This is a good story. 2 days later, on Sunday night, August 23rd, 1981, so 2 days after Barbara Virginia Simons' 40-stab-wounded body is found by this little newspaper boy, so 2 days later, on Sunday night, August 23rd, 1981, the phones at the Minneapolis 911 dispatch start ringing again. And here is that call. Are you ready for me to pretend to hit play?
Yeah. I also like how you say Minneapolis. It's sort of like a tiny Annapolis where military people are trained. So where did you go to school? Minneapolis. Oh, isn't it that Annapolis Community College? They only train Marines.
Little bitty Marines to fight infections. Like Osmosis Jones.
All right, here's the call. I'm going to pretend that you're pressing play. Here we go.
Here we go!
By your emergency.
Please don't talk to him, listen. I'm sorry I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one. Oh, my chief. Oh, I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red chin on it, it's me. I killed both of them. I'm sorry. I'll never make it.
Whoa.
That was it. He hung up.
Yeah.
So, and I want to say, that the way he approaches when the 911 call operator first answers is how I've often find myself communicating with my children. Please don't talk. Just listen. And then I go on talking about that time I killed that girl.
You ever tried starting a conversation with your wife that way? Don't try.
Please don't talk.
The only time that I've ever tried to have a conversation preface with that with my wife was one time where I spent way too much money, but I needed to explain it. That happened this week, actually.
They're actually commenting in the comment section about how sweaty you are.
I am so hot in here. It's 82 degrees. You have no idea. Oh.
Just turn your air conditioner on low or something.
I can't. Yeah. I can't. Alexa doesn't know how to do that.
You look like you've been calling police stations and confessing the murders.
I wouldn't be as hot except for I have these big headphones on and I'm laughing a lot. I really should have brought in some cooling drinks.
Now, we don't have time to make this a 3-hour episode about who this guy is. So I'm just going to go ahead and blow this wad all over your face up.
Okay.
The man you hear in those calls and the man that committed those crimes was named Paul Michael Stefani. Now, on top of attacking Karen Potack with that tire iron, and on top of stabbing Kimberly Compton and Barbara Simons to death with an ice pick, remember, an ice pick. They thought it was a screwdriver. That ended up being his weapon of choice, an ice pick. On top of all that, because those are the ones that he had called about, he had also murdered a 33-year-old woman named Kathleen Greening by drowning her in her own bathtub in her home in Roseville on July 21st of 1982. And that murder, the one of Kathleen Greening here, is about a year after the murder of Barbara Simons, who he just called about, the one that we just listened about. Now, Kathleen Greening and Paul Michael Stefani had met at a bar out on University Avenue, and they had dated a few times prior to the murder. On the night of her murder, he called Kathleen and arranged to come see her at her home. She said, yeah, come on over. Come on over here, big fella. And when he got there, they had sex, and then they went and took a bath together. And while they were in the bath, Paul fucking drowned her.
Wow.
He just held her head underwater and drowned her. And interestingly enough, earlier that night, when Kathleen had answered the door, Paul was standing there on the step holding the ice pick from the previous murders. She looked him up and down. She looked at that ice pick. She looked him up and down. She looked at his bulge. And then she went back to that ice pick. She said, just leave it out here on the stairs. And that's true.
Wow.
I didn't make that up. She said, what are you doing with that ice pick, Paul? Leave it on the steps.
Wow.
Haven't you heard? There's been two young ladies murdered with an ice pick. Leave that on the steps. People are going to think something. He's like, I'm sorry, Kathleen. I bring an ice pick everywhere I go. It's Minnesota. Later, she was found by her best friend, Carol Kellogg, later that evening in the bathtub. She was naked, face up in the water, and the water was still running. It was running over her forehead as her head kind of bobbed beneath the water there, the water line. Her knees were bent backwards and her legs were tucked underneath her body in the bathtub, which kind of makes you believe that maybe they were facing each other in the bath. She was on her knees and he choked. He like grabbed her and Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Forced her backwards.
Like they were doing one of those, like a double mermaid out of the water. La! And then he grabs her and pushes her backward and drowns her.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
A scorpion. That's what they call it on Ridiculousness.
Yep, scorpion.
Can I not say that, Jess? Can I call it? I'm sorry.
Jess?
Paul never made a non.
This is the part you asked.
This
about.
One.
Well, I didn't want to be offensive. Paul never made a 911 call after murdering Kathleen. possibly because he was afraid he was close to being caught. Fun fact about Kathleen Greening's murder is it was a big deal politically because she had political connections, and why am I having a brain fart right now? What is it where we put people up and we say, I want that guy.
Candidate.
And another guy goes, I want election. Elections. That was the word I was looking for. What just happened?
I don't know.
She was a political figure, and elections were going around. It's a lot of convoluted political mumbo jumbo, but there was speculation that another politician had killed her, and it turns out it was just this asshole. But
was her best friend Carol Kellogg, was she related to the cereal by any chance?
I don't know. You know, I was worried about that when you started this episode talking about cereal.
Yeah.
And I knew that Carol Kellogg was going to come up in this story.
Right.
And I was not excited to get to her name. I actually considered leaving it out.
Yet you didn't, because you knew that I would catch on to it like a piranha.
And you did.
Yeah.
And this is the first murder he doesn't make a phone call. I will say that Wikipedia, as well as a slew of other podcasts, say that Kathleen was the third victim to be killed, but this is not true, and I have the old newspaper articles to prove it. She was the last victim. She was the last victim to be murdered. Not technically the last victim, but the last murder victim.
Huh.
So here's the backstory on those three calls that we just listened to. We listened to three. If you remember, call one, it was Karen Potak, the first victim. She survived. She was hit over the head with a tire iron. This is what happened leading up to that attack. Turns out Karen Potak was just in the wrong place at the wrong fucking time, because it turns out that Paul Michael Stefani had actually just been fired from the Malberg manufacturing machine shop there that Karen was found behind.
Oh.
And what had happened is he had went there kind of stalking around the joint, just trying to kill somebody around there as like a little revenge thing. She had been walking home that night from a New Year's Eve party, and that's when Paul Michael Stefani spotted her on the road there close to the machine shop. And we have a little bit of audio here of Paul Michael Stefani talking about finding Karen Potak and what he did to her.
She got in my car, and I gave her my jacket until I said, the heat will be on in a minute. I had to clean some of the ice off the windshield.
Do you remember where you hit her with the tire iron? Did you hit her one time, two times?
Yeah, it must have been about 30 times. I mean, a good 20 times, I think, about.
Were you swinging it this way, or did you poke her with it?
I don't think I poked her at all. I remember that. Mainly on the forehead, by the cheek, and the jaw, the mouth, the top of the head. I think it was only about 10 times, because I know she must really be hurt in that. Feel hard like that.
Is he insane? No. Is he different than most people that you see? Yes. And as he relived these incidents, he dropped back into the same voice and same person that he was 20 some years ago.
There's going like this. I mean, that's what I'm going to make you want to go to the phone. I mean, where's the one that helped this? My mind started clearing up. What are you doing? You had a chance to make another friend that could feel another soul. You like to make friends.
6 months.
So what's weird about that to me is when the guy is saying, do you think he's crazy? But then you listen to him. One of the things I think is missing from what he says.
What?
Ads. Gotta pay the bills. Gotcha. Okay, all right, we're back. Kent's leaving. It pains me to get him like that, but oh, wow.
So you just heard it from the horse's mouth. talking about op. Now, you just heard it from the horse's mouth, Paul, here. He saw her, and then he attacked her. Fortunately, like I said, she survived despite having some brain damage. She did survive. Later, he would say that instead of attacking somebody in revenge for getting fired, he should have, quote, just burned the place down, unquote. This is basically that guy with the glasses in Office Space.
I blame you on my stapler, that guy. Oh, wow.
Now, call two. If you remember call two, it was our first murder victim, young Kimberly Compton, who was new in town. If you're wondering the buildup, what got us there to her body laying there with the many, many stab wounds in it? Like I said, she was discovered by those three boys. Turns out Kimberly had stepped off that Greyhound bus at the depot there on 9th and St. Peter Street and had walked across the street to a little restaurant called Mickey's Diner. Remember, she was new in town. She was looking for a job. She gets off this bus and goes right across the street to Mickey's Diner. But unfortunately for her, inside, Paul Michael Stefani is sitting in there with a friend having a cup of coffee and cutting up. They're having a good time. They're drinking coffee. Kimberly sits near them. And when Paul cracks a joke to his friend, he catches her laughing about it. And that's when he uses this as an opportunity to break the ice. And that's how he gets into her good graces. And we have another clip here, Paul talking about what happened with Kimberly.
The bus.
And then I told me where she was from. In Wisconsin, Mom, the fence. I was like, hey, I'm not even thinking about anything right now. Hey, why don't you let me show you about Paul?
According to Stefani, Kimberly Compton agreed to go for a ride and see the sights of St. Paul at night.
I'll show you the valley. You really have a nice view over here. I mean, you see the major good thing. I think I mentioned somebody you can probably have something to tell your parents about that.
So he uses the pretense of the view. They get out of the car, and he says he parks the car in the bushes.
I have any intention to hurt him. You lay down in the grass, and I remember opening up a bra, and just killing it. And it starts
that. Wow.
Yeah. So what happened is she sits down there. He breaks the ice with her. They talk for a minute, and then he offers to give her a tour of the town since she's new. I'll show you around the place, let you see some things. She agrees to go with him and leaves with him, and she's never seen alive again. Now, in that clip, I know it might be hard to hear, but what he says is that they messed around a little bit in the grass, and that's when he pulled out what ended up being an ice pick. I don't know why I said a knife, and killing her, stabbing her to death. I think what I think is more likely is that he forced himself on her, because I can't see this young girl. I mean, if you look at pictures of this dude, he looks like... This is such a vague reference, a probably unknown reference to most people, but the shitty dad from the original Return of the or Night of the Living Dead, the black and white Night of the Living Dead, the one that goes down in the basement, he's just an ugly motherfucker.
Yeah. I'm surprised anybody's, like, how does he keeps getting these ladies, and it's kind of, I don't understand it.
Yeah, you have a good point, because Kathleen Greening, if you see pictures of her, the politician lady, she was very attractive, and they apparently had dated. So I don't know if this guy had some kind of spell over women. I don't know, but apparently he didn't have a hard time with chicks, despite the fact that he looked like the kind of guy that would rape and kill a woman, even though he technically has never been charged with any rapes. They didn't find evidence of rape in any of these women.
This is all the 80s, too, also. So
it was the 80s, yeah. Call number three. Remember call number three? That was the murder of 40-year-old Barbara Simons. That's the lady that was found by the newspaper boy. She also had multiple stab wounds. Story behind her. Her and Paul Michael Stefani had actually met at a bar earlier that night that she was murdered, at a bar called the Hexagon Bar. And they met by her asking Paul for a cigarette, and he gave her one, and they hit it off. They drank that night away together, and then she ended up leaving with him, never to be seen alive again. Her last words to a waitress before she left were, quote, he's cute. I hope he's nice since he's given me a ride home.
He's not cute at all.
Unquote. He's not.
No, he looks like a harbinger of doom. He literally looks like a harbinger of doom.
He does. Kind of guy that would shine your shoes in the bathroom of Denver International Airport. Oh. Going to St. Louis, are we, Mr. Wilbur? That's a shame. Have a blast.
That's a callback, if you don't know what we're talking about, to our Never Daily show.
So you're probably wondering, how did this big old piece of shit get caught? And if you weren't, I'll tell you anyway. On August 21st, 1982, Paul Stefani, our villain here, he picks up a 19-year-old prostitute by the name of Denise Williams down there in Minneapolis. Minneapolis. Down there in Minneapolis. He picks her up, and after turning on a dark, dead-end road, he suddenly turns and just begins stabbing her with, this time, a screwdriver. He stabbed her a total of 15 times before she was able to... If you remember, this is the 80s, and what did we make Pepsi bottles out of in the 80s?
Coke bottles.
Nope, glass. We made it out of glass. You were so close, and at the same time, not even anywhere near it. Glass. She had a Pepsi glass bottle, and we're talking about one of those with the screw cap, right? Remember the...
Yes.
And she busts it over his face as he's stabbing her and leaves a deep, deep gash in his left cheek. A very serious injury. She's screaming while she's fighting. This girl's fighting like a banshee. He finally went and fucked with the wrong one. While she's screaming, her screams get the attention of a man that lived nearby, and he comes running. This is one of the heroes in the story. This man comes up on the scene and sees Paul inside the vehicle trying to continue to stab Denise, and that's when this man and Paul get into a wrestling match through the window. She uses this opportunity to jump out of the car, and Paul slams on the gas and speeds off into the night. Denise did survive her wounds and actually was later able to finger him in court. In front of everybody.
Right. I mean, she was a woman of the night.
She would do that if you had $40. But I meant finger, like point. Like the way that judges say it.
That man right there.
Finger him.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she didn't go like two knuckles in. But.
Jeez.
Paul speeds off into the night, and Denise and this man that comes to her aid, they call an ambulance, and the police are notified, hey, we're on the lookout. She described him, the man that wrestled him described him, and they're also made aware that he has a large gash on his cheek that's definitely going to need medical attention. And guess what? Paul gets back to his apartment and realizes he fucking does need medical attention, and that's when he calls an ambulance for himself, and that's when police show up because there's already a bolo for a man with a bad facial injury. They show up, he matches the description, and that's how Paul is busted, and in 1997, Paul Michael Stefani is diagnosed with inoperable and incurable lung cancer and given a maximum of 2 years to live, and he fucking dies at Oak Park Heights Prison on June 12th, 1998. The end. Thank you. You ready for a happy ending?
Yes, please.
Happy ending. This happy ending also went to the 80s for my happy ending for this episode, and that happens April 6, 1986. That's when a young lady by the name of Antoinette Cayadito disappears from her New Mexico home. Now, according to her sister Wendy, Cayadito answered a knock at the door, and she was just grabbed and kidnapped by two men. They didn't know who the men were. And 1 year after she disappeared, a young girl claiming to be Cayadito phones in to the police. And that is the call you will hear now.
Police department.
Hello. I'm Angela Cayadito.
Okay, whereabouts in Albuquerque?
You said you could just... Oh,
hello? Antoinette, where are you? Antoinette? Hello.
Now, I know that call sounds incredibly disturbing, and it's short. She's clearly in distress. She says her name's Antoinette Cayadito and claims that she's in Albuquerque. Now, before she can give any more information, an adult can be heard yelling at the girl for using the phone, and then she screams, and then she's clearly dragged. Now, her mother does listen to this audio and believes that it is indeed her daughter. And that's when 2 months later, nothing happened, and she's still missing to this day.
Oh, God. You son of a...
But she might still be alive.
And that's the silver lining.
So that's a happy ending.
That's happy.
She might still be alive.
Might still be alive.
We don't know. We haven't found a little body.
That's...
Anywhere, so... Hugs, everybody.
Ugh. Oof. All right. Well, I don't know.
You want to listen to the call again? Play it again.
No, it's okay. I think the music.
She might still be alive.
She might be.
What is the fucking problem here?
I think we should just hold out hope. I think you're good. Make a good. She obviously knows how to use a phone. She could use it again, and maybe we'll just hope she does someday. All right. Well, 1159 Media did something at a podcast, and this is one of them. I don't have to say it because it's your show.
Hugs, everybody. Bye.